Good afternoon. Welcome to the Space Show, John.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
A number of proposals have been made over the years to commercialize space activities. One of them was the SpaceHab. Could you tell us a little bit about SpaceHab, please?
Well, SpaceHab is a concept that started a number of years ago to expand what's called the mid-deck locker portion of the space shuttle by adding a module in the bay of the space shuttle, which would have locker space that could be used for experiments or other activities in space. It looks a little like a small version of the space lab module and is connected with a tunnel into the crew compartment through the door that goes into the cargo compartment. The current status of SpaceHab is that they have received a contract from NASA for roughly $183 million. They have begun construction and have been able to secure their financing finally after much difficulty. It's a new concept, so they had a very hard time getting the community, the financial community, to go ahead and support it.
And that support, of course, includes not only the construction costs, but also people willing to fly payloads aboard it.
Well, the money from NASA is not for construction. The money for NASA is advance payments on use of approximately 50% of the facility for a certain number of flights. And what they're in fact doing is prepaying that. And the company SpaceHab is using those funds in addition to funds derived from bank loans and equity participation, where they have significant equity participation actually from this part of the world, from Taiwan and Japan.
I see. And when will that first fly?
If I may be off on this, but I think the first flight is scheduled for 1994.
Right. There was another proposal for commercialization of space, again involving the space shuttle, and that was to have something called the Industrial Space Facility. What happened to that in the end?
That was proposed several years ago by a company in Texas called Space Industries, started by a gentleman named Max Faget, who is a former NASA engineer, and now he has become the chairman of the board, and the president is a gentleman named Joe Allen, who flew on the shuttle and was an astronaut that some of your listeners may have remembered as one of the people who rescued one of the satellites that was up there. It was intended to be a free-flying, man-tended facility located in an orbit so it could be reached by the space shuttle and in effect, man-tended. The men would only be in it when the shuttle was actually attached to it. The concept received some support from various quarters in the United States. However, NASA did not feel that they had adequate amount of use for it, and the requirement that Space Industries had was that NASA take a position similar to the one they've taken with regard to SpaceHab that we discussed before, only at a much higher dollar level, roughly $700 million. NASA did not feel that they had the ability to do that. They did put out a request for proposal. They called it a CDSF, commercially developed
space facility. Yes.
And the problem was that simply the budget money never materialized for it, and without the commitment from NASA to take a fairly large position with regard to using it or becoming a customer, it was unable to secure the necessary funding.
Almost all space programs have been government-funded. Possible exception, of course, commercial communications satellites and a few remote sensing satellites. One of the remote sensing type of vehicle that Australia uses, of course, are the American weather satellites. At the moment, Australia gets that information for free and has done ever since the 1960s. And we as Australians must wonder at the generosity of the American taxpayer in allowing us free access to this data. Of course, in return, they get our weather data from ground stations. But is there any moves afoot in the United States to make Australia and the other countries around the world pay for this service?
Well, not in the direct sense that you have stated it, but there are several things happening. For example, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, N-O-A-A, which operates the U.S. Weather Service satellites, have two polar orbiting weather satellites. They're made by General Electric called Tyros. And they, the data from those are the data that you get here in Australia. For budgetary reasons, NOAA is not going to launch. It's a morning and an afternoon satellite. For budgetary reasons, NOAA is only going to do the afternoon satellite from now on. They are in discussions with an organization called EUMETSAT, the European Meteorological Satellite Activity, to take over the ownership and operation of the morning meteorological satellite. One can speculate that this is a precursor. As budgets get tight in the United States and in Europe and throughout the world, one can speculate that these types of facilities are not going to be able to go on forever in a free mode to so many countries. So one might think or might speculate that in the not too distant future one may be required to ask people to pay. In a matter of fact, I was told in a briefing recently in Washington by the head of the satellite division at NOAA, Mr. Tom Pike, that there are lots of places in the world where people do pay for weather data and interpretation. So there are precedents out there. I don't think it's something that's going to happen in the near future, but as I said, as budget pressures continue to escalate, then the chances are there that countries like Australia throughout the world will simply be asked to make some kind of contribution.
And what sort of contribution do you think we should make? Should it be just pay up, or is there any other way that we can sort of get some bargaining leverage?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. Pay up can be done in money, it can be done in kind. It is being done, as you point out, by providing very useful surface weather data from your own meteorological services here. One idea that's been floated several times in the United States is the thoughts of having an international organization, perhaps on the lines of Intelsat or Inmarsat, the satellite organizations, which would run remote sensing of all kinds, including weather, on an international basis, in which countries like Australia and everyone else would participate, either through in-kind contributions or through financial contributions. And what the advantage of that is, there would be certain cost savings by reducing the redundancy that's necessary, or economies of scale in buying more than one spacecraft, or for meeting multiple worldwide requirements.
So rather than the United States running its own national satellite service, and again the European Space Agency with EUMETSAT operating its own satellites, we'd have something more like Intelsat or Inmarsat.
Yes, that's the thought, in the sense that one would sit and one would put up a system where, for example, the geosynchronous weather satellites, the ones that you get your evening weather pictures from, actually are owned by and operated by the Japanese. But the Japanese buy one or two satellites, the U.S. buys two or three satellites, the Europeans buy two or three satellites and put them in geosynchronous orbit. There is no reason that one could not buy a single geosynchronous weather satellite that met everyone's need, and instead of buying them in lots of two or three, buy the necessary eight or ten. The economies of scale in doing that would be significant, would cause the costs of such satellites to go down dramatically.
A number of proposals have been made for commercial launch services in the United States. They appear, from our viewpoint, to have been proposed. A few even reach test launch status, and then they seem to vanish. Now, what is the problem that prevents these from becoming ongoing commercial enterprises?
Well, we have commercial launch services. McDonnell Douglas, General Dynamics, they would consider themselves commercial. In
yes.
Their defense, I must say they are.
I was going to add the rider, other than those who initially got government funding as startup, often derived from an initial ICBM or military rocket. Other than those companies...
Well, they didn't get government funding in the sense that you mean it. The government was a customer for the military, for their rocket.
Yes.
And if they were contractors to the government who simply shifted over to try to sell the same product they'd been making for the government on a private basis. If you want to call it, rather than commercialization, you can call it privatization of what was previously government equipment.
Okay. Now turning to the smaller services.
Well, several of them are still alive. Some of them are more well than others, but the major problem that they've all faced is that they are generally startup ventures, and they have been characterized as being small companies with limited capital and limited funding. Two of them are still, I would consider, viable commercially. The one that's probably best known is the Pegasus program done by Orbital Sciences, which had a successful flight about a year and a half ago, and is scheduled to have its next flight either later this month or early in June. As a matter of fact, through several contracts with NASA, with DARPA, which is a part of the Defense Department's Research and Development Agency, and others, there are orders on the books for 60 Pegasus launch vehicles, which is a significant number and probably ensures that that venture will be a success.
If are they firm launches, or are they firm orders, or
are they
simply reservations?
They're firm orders.
All right.
They're mostly government. There are a few that are being talked about from private industry, but they are firm orders. The other company is a company called SSI, Space Systems, Inc., in Houston, Texas, which has one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts, Deke Slayton, as its president. They have struggled considerably. They launched a rocket called the Conestoga about 8 years ago now, which was the first quote commercial launch ever, though it only launched a lot of water. They haven't launched anything since. However, they were just the winner on a contract with NASA for a program called COMET, which is a launch and reentry capsule activity, which is being used by the NASA Center for the Commercial Development of Space for experimentation. Winning that contract, assuming that they can perform under it, and I have no reason to doubt that they can, should give them a sufficient shot in the arm to become viable. Companies such as American Rocket and others are still very much in existence. How healthy they are and how long they will last will depend on a lot of things that they're trying to control in a positive way, but may or may not go their way. So in effect, there are two of them, I think, that have got a real chance.
In each of the examples we've talked about, although the company, the rocket company, is a commercial venture with private funding, Pegasus and Conestoga are both relying on government contracts, either through the military or through the civilian NASA agency.
Mm-hmm.
None of them are building a commercial vehicle and going straight into the civilian market. The commercial market. They're all relying on government funding. Now, that to me seems to parallel the situation here in Australia, where we do have a proposal for an Australian launch vehicle. And again, in order to get that commercial market, it does need this initial Australian government input.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that parallel?
There are some similarities, yes. The Australian launch vehicle, as it's a program with which I am familiar, is looking for the Australian government to help them by funding two demonstration launches, as I'm sure you're aware. That's a little different because what, for example, Orbital Sciences with Pegasus was looking for is government contracts to sustain production. They, with help from DARPA, put together the Pegasus, or DARPA was their first customer. I have problems, I guess, with the concept that if you sell to the government, you're not commercial. One can argue
agreed, yes.
Companies like Lockheed, which have stockholders, do 98% of their business with the government. One certainly would have to call them commercial. It has been a characteristic of space since its history that it has the governments have dominated. Most of the reason for that is it's been, up until fairly recently, state-of-the-art research. I think if you go back to the communication satellite example, the early communication satellites were done as government programs. The later stages of communication satellites, when a market was proven, have switched over to being mostly commercial. It will take some time for that to happen in all areas. If programs like the Comet program are successful, and you start having companies such as those that are involved in the CCDSs, the Centers for the Commercial Development of Space, having some success with their experimentation, then you're going to see companies coming forward to actually want to fly, and you'll see a commercial market develop. But right now, you must the people in this business must recognize reality. And reality is that the people who are in doing things in space, who have the money to spend, happen to be governments.
Well, thank you, John, for joining us today on the Space
Show.
It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you.